James Burton conducting Schola Cantorum Oxford, and that was Randall Thompson's Ye Shall Have a Song. And that is it for this Sunday morning. I will be back as ever next Sunday from 10. I do hope you'll join me then.
Sunday Morning with Susie Klein is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Linda Jones.
A week of winners in Performance on 3 continues with the 2010 British Composer Awards. Join us on Wednesday night as we bring you the 8th annual award ceremony from the British Academy of Songwriters, Composers and Authors, celebrating the new works of the last 12 months, this year with a particular focus on vocal music. Performance on 3, Wednesday night from 7 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now it's just gone midday and it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. And this week's edition was first broadcast in 2002.
Howard Jacobson's new novel is called Who's Sorry Now, and it's hugely entertaining. You've written, I think, it's about 6 altogether.
This is the seventh.
Seventh.
Right. Seventh novel. I think I've written about 11 or 12 books, but this is the seventh novel.
And was literature always a sort of mainstay in your life? Was it the first thing you really wanted
to
do?
Yes, I was born wanting to be a novelist. I don't remember ever wanting to be anything else. They were my only heroes, were novelists. You'll hear in the course of this programme that the other thing I would love to have been was a tenor, but that was never realistic. So I always wanted to be a novelist, and still to this day, the only people I really revere are novelists. They need not to be alive now for me to feel free of any competitive edge.
Helps.
But novelists, yes, are the thing for me. They speak the word.
And were you surrounded by culturally provocative ideas when you were young, or did you have to discover them for yourself?
By any means, it was not an intellectual household. We were not surrounded by books or music. Music was not played in the house. I was a standard, introverted, sensitive lad, of which, you know, most...
Which you've remained.
Which I have remained. But of the usual sort. But for some reason, I felt I had to... There was a world out there that had to be reconstructed. I had to be the master of my universe. And the only way I ever imagined doing it was to write stories.
The first music that you've chosen, it has a slightly lachrymose element to it, or at least something otherworldly about it. What attracted you?
The sacred. Bach's version of the sacred is nothing like the sacred which I knew as a Jewish boy hearing it in the synagogue. It might have been the thrill of somebody else's sacred that attracted me to Bach. In the first place, it was clean and pure and crystalline in a way that nothing I knew about the sacred and really did not believe in the sacred as I grew up into and like it. It took Bach to make me believe there could be such a place. One or two writers do it, maybe Dunn does it, maybe Hopkins does it. But in music, it's Bach for me who just... And by the sacred, I don't mean the mundane rendered more solemn. I mean, actually another place of pure stillness and quiet that I adore.
Especially with a singer like this.
What I love about her is just the clarity of her voice. Her voice has the sacred in it, but also the intelligence. There's no wallowing here. It's absolutely pure, and you feel she's thinking as she's singing. I mean, if only actors could read poetry the way she enunciates and feels her way through these words.
Thank you.
know what I particularly love about that? That there's no wallowing in death. There's no luxuriating in the idea of ceasing upon the midnight with no pain. It somehow, it feels that to remove oneself from life, sung like that and composed like that, is the sanest thing one could do. It's a sort of, it's a vote for life and all one's human intelligence that one should choose to do it.
Janet Baker singing Schlummert ein ihr matten Augen from the cantata number 82 Ich habe genug by Bach, the Bath Festival Orchestra, directed by Yehudi Menuhin. Now, Howard, you, I'm afraid, will never make a sound like that unless you have a little operation, possibly, but the sound you would like to make is different anyway, isn't it? Because
yes.
The voice you would really love to have is a great tenor voice, isn't it?
Yes, I had party turns until I realised that people weren't applauding me, they were probably laughing at me. But I did believe for a while that I could actually make noises like the great ones. And the great ones for me were Caruso and Gigli and Bjorling, the sweetest of them all. But also, I have to confess, I could go Mario Lanza as well. And Mario Lanza has his moments. It was hard for me not to choose a Mario Lanza. When I first got a gramophone of my own and I could buy LPs and I would take these tenors and I would listen to them at a time when I should really have been out dancing with girls my own age. Maybe I was a little young for that. I was certainly shy. And I would just sit in a dark room and I would weep over these.
Yes, now I remember doing much the same thing. And the interesting thing is that there are only at any one time three or four tenors that can actually sing those particular roles, and it's true of certain Wagner roles too, which makes it very special. I mean, you can't imagine, however wonderful they are, Peter Peers, Robert Tyr, Ian Bostridge singing or wanting to sing Puccini arias. It's a different animal, isn't it?
Do you think it's something in nature? Do you think it's some Darwinian thing that nature sees to it that there are only three
Italian.
Or four? So that there, yes.
Yes.
Yes, of course, the lovely thing about Bjorling, who was my favourite, was he wasn't Italian. And yet somehow or other he was able to be, I think it was said of him, that he was more Italian even than any Italian. I've noticed in a lot of the music that I've chosen, there's a lot of cross-cultural things, people from one culture being in another culture.
That's
and I
certain.
Hadn't realised that when I chose it, but maybe it's something to do with my own sense of extraneousness or foreign.
Cross-fertilisation.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm. Which bit are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Your Tiny Hand is Frozen. Mm. The Italian for which you can give, from La Bohème, but in that great, that wonderful version with Beecham conducting and Victoria de Los Angeles singing Mimi.
Signore, rimedi in mi d'amore.
I don't think any composer knew better how to find his way into the heart of a 12-year-old boy. It's very sort of unsettling. Yeah. I certainly got an erotic charge out of it, and I do now, listening to slightly seasick emotionalism. And I guess it's not a coincidence that half the time, as he's falling in love with Mimi, he's actually telling her that he's a writer. And he's assuming that he's telling her that he's a writer will be all it needs for her to fall in love with him. It's no coincidence that this was my favourite aria.
Que jolie de manina from La Bohème, Act 1 by Puccini. Jussi Björling with the RCA Victor Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Beecham. I wonder how, just thinking of your new novel, Hr. Jacobson, which is about wonderful character called Marvin Kreitman, the luggage baron par excellence of South London, who thinks largely about sex, well, women anyway, for most of the time, and compares them with a great friend. And I wondered whether you feel there's anything he could have learnt from Don Giovanni.
Well, the thing about Marvin Kreitman is he would have listened to Don, given what I know of him as his creator, and then at the end of the novel, his friend. He would have loved Don Giovanni and would have liked to have seen himself as a Don Giovanni. They would have known that the day of Don Giovanni had gone, since part of what Don Giovanni is about is, if you like, blasphemy. Don Giovanni is in an argument with God as well as with women. In fact, he's more in an argument with God, and doing what he does with women is simply his way of doing that. Kreitman is in no argument with God, and probably no man is anymore. Kreitman very much feels his day has been and gone. The other side of Kreitman, of course, is he would also have loved Jussi Björling, because he weeps a lot, Kreitman. But one of the reasons I love Mozart and love Don Giovanni is he's so intelligent about what the pleasure of being, whatever word you want to use for Don Giovanni, is, that it's not simply cynical, that it's not simply opportunist, that at the moment in which he addresses a woman, he pours his heart out, not quite as Rodolfo does, because he's always in control, but he does, the music convinces you, he does anyway, fall in love at that moment. And the other thing that Mozart is so good at doing is showing you why a woman might fall for it, why a woman might even welcome it, even at the moment when she knows it's probably cynical and she's probably lost.
But do you think there's an element of wickedness in Don Giovanni? I mean, after all, people do get killed at the beginning.
Yes, without doubt there is. He's sent down to hell. He goes down to hell. He is, if you like, he is a villain. But he is given these moments of exquisite beauty, and they have their own moral force. There is nothing you can do about it. Thank you. Could actually hear her heart flutter there. I love the way they sort of come apart, he to do his thing and her to express her anxieties, and then come together again, so that by the end you do have a genuine mutuality. And the most poignant and pressing andiam comes from her, I think, so that it is a real mutual coming together. I mean, you can't talk about that as a seduction in the end. That's what's so wonderful about it.
Somehow the music is completely non-judgmental.
Yes, entirely. It is dramatic in the full sense of the word. It does supremely what art is meant to do, which is to enter into how it feels for those two people to be those two people at that moment.
Lacci darem la mano from Don Giovanni, Act 1, Scene 3 by Mozart, of course. Graziele Sciuti as Zerlina and Eberhard Wächter as Don Giovanni with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. Well, it's back to your mum for the next piece, isn't it?
Yes. I would have heard this with her on the radio countless times. This was the sort of music, well, not just the sort of music, this was a piece that was played a lot, I guess, in the 50s. I don't know whether there was a revival of the musical then. I think the musical dates from before then, does it? Or maybe I've got that wrong. Maybe it was a 50s musical. But we heard it a lot, and she kind of sang it, and it's a real... It's schmaltzy beyond belief. I mean, it is a version of what we've just been hearing, really. I now see that I've chosen three love songs or love duets on the run, and this is the real schmaltzed-up version. I think it's quite high-quality schmaltz, as schmaltz goes. And I particularly love it, again, because we've got that foreign thing that I like, that Georges Guttery, who's one half of the duet, is... I mean, not just French. I mean, he's spectacularly, unbelievably, impossibly never was such a Frenchman. But I wanted to be this sort of Frenchman in the same way that I wanted to be Rodolfo, the writer. I thought this man seemed to carry some idea of bygone sophistication. Well, judge for yourself.
Lovely day, this is the day I shall remember, the day I am dying. They can't take this away, it will be always mine, the sun and the wine, the sea birds cry. Happiness must pay, and if our ship goes down, she'll go with the flood still flying.
But look at me and say, you will remember too that this was our love.
I'll remember
It's the remembering that's going on there. He remembers, he promises to remember, she promises to remember. The possibility of their forgetting is there. I'm remembering them remembering.
Lisbeth Webb and Georges Guettieri were singing This Is My Lovely Day from Bless the Bride by Vivian Ellis. Chamber music next. Do you find that your love of music is compartmentalised, or is it just a much more general thing about from which various things come to the surface?
When I got to know chamber music, which was, I suppose, university, I think I first heard some chamber music, I thought this is it for me. And I kind of got to the difficult stuff first. I knew it existed, but I got to late Beethoven somehow or other very quick. And I thought, this is it for me. This is like writing. This is like the interior world of writing, and it's like the writing I most like. It had that difficulty, and it had that sense of voices quietly speaking to one another, where the orchestra didn't give me that. The orchestra sounded more like the prose I wouldn't like to read or write. But chamber music found me. I, in the end, had to stop it for the same reason that I had to stop listening to Jussi Björling and Georges Guettieri. It was too emotional. I actually had a friend, one of my students in Australia, who was himself a musician and came from a musical family, and he taught me a lot more about chamber music. And his parents actually forbade him listening to late Beethoven. They just thought it was bad for him. It was making him disturbed. It does send you a long way into yourself. And then I discovered not just Schubert, who is probably of all composers my most favourite, the most naturally, I'm not saying anything here that anybody doesn't know, the most naturally lyrical of all romantic composers.
Also very human for a novelist, I
yes,
think.
Yes. And the songs are like little poems or like little chapters. But not only did I discover that there was a certain lyrical quality that released me from those tensions of Beethoven in Schubert. But then someone introduced me to this piano trio. And the piano, I thought, was very important because it broke up. It broke up the interiority, if you like, of the stringed instruments. It spoke to them in a brighter voice. It sort of jollied them out of it, so to speak. It was more prosaic. And I thought, this gives me the best of both worlds. I'm not sinking into something really quite terribly melancholy here. And this is, I think, the loveliest of all. I then listened to quite a few trios and things, or whatever chamber music I could find that had a piano in. I thought, I can get everything here. This is the most lovely of them. Not least, I think, because, again, it's an old recording, and I seem to like old recordings so that I can have the nostalgia of the double nostalgia of it. But I think Thibaut, the violinist, had been a popular violinist. I think you can just hear a little trace of sort of something else in it, something not quite of the classical world, maybe even something of the palm court.
Well, these are wonderful players, Thibaut, Casals and Corto.
Thank you.
Well, that was part of the second movement from the piano trio in B-flat, Deutsch 898 by Schubert. And we heard three legendary players, Jacques Thibault playing the violin, Pablo Casals the cello, and Alfred Corto the piano. Actually, curiously enough, Howard Jacobson, the next piece is also an old performance looking at music that was visionary in its day. This is Nadia Boulanger's ensemble singing Monteverdi.
I surprised myself by the number of old records. I'm sure there's a deep psychological reason for all this, and I guess it's something to do with piling on as much nostalgia as I can and melancholy as I can, because that seems to be what I'm sure this is absolutely impermissible, but that seems to be what I primarily go to music for, and the more of it I can find. In this case, it's I think Nadia Boulanger was responsible really for reawakening an interest in Monteverdi. Purists, I know, because I've heard them, think this is absolutely what a Monteverdi madrigal should not sound like, played on the wrong instruments, and it's got the wrong everything, it's emotionally wrong. But I still listened to it and liked it. And for a long time you couldn't get this record, and I'd lost my earlier one. And it was a search for it, really, that was like a search for meaning itself, to try and find this music again. I was emotionally attached to it too, because it was first played to me by someone who taught me English at Cambridge, Maurice Shapira. We had to do some Italian, and we did in those days to go with our English, and we read some Dante. He gave us Dante classes, and he also gave us Monteverdi to listen to help our Italian. He died in tragic circumstances some years ago, and sort of the vanished music and the vanished hymn have something to do with each other for me.
And this is very passionate music again, isn't it?
Ardo, ardo, it's about, yes, it's burning. It really is burning, and it's of a voluptuousness that's incomparable, I think. I've never heard anything like, I mean, they're dying with love there. An awful lot of people dying with love in my choice. I don't know what it means. where some of the other music, the other love music we've listened to, is about the swagger of love, or how you want to put feeling in love to yourself, or how you want to express love to another person, and all powerfully what it's like to feel it. But this seems to be at another level. It's almost as if this has gone inside, and this is what your heart feels like, or this is what the physiology of love feels like. You know, it's trapped in the purple heat of it. There's a cry for help at one point, isn't there? Natural socorro, as if you're trying to get out of something. It's fantastic about how, once you are in the throes of love, how absolutely helpless you are in it.
Ardo e Scopria from Monteverdi, Nadia Boulanger directing an ensemble and playing the piano. Now, being a mighty waltzer yourself, Howard, this is one of the great waltzes from The Merry Widow, isn't it, next?
Yes, not that I am a great waltzer, unfortunately. Of the tenors that I adored, I told you that Björling was my favourite, but Tauber had a special... I believed I could imitate Tauber. I believed I could do that. I adored Tauber. I still do adore Tauber. I think the combination of Lehár and Tauber gives me some Austro-Hungarian longing. I have Austro-Hungarian longings on me, it seems. God knows why. It might partly be that we all did at that point, or we all do, and it might partly be a Jewish thing. Most of us didn't know where we came from properly. It took a while before, you know, some of us knew it was Russia, but it wasn't always Russia. I always had a vague sense it was... I thought I came from Vienna, actually. When Tauber sang about Vienna, I thought, well, he's singing about my birthplace. When I saw The Third Man and saw war-torn Vienna, I thought, that's me, that's something. There's something about the emotionalism of that place that I associate with. And Tauber gave me that. And there's something just about that kind of grandeur of an age that was gone that we're all yearning for, that Tauber gets for me. And a certain kind of preposterous fruitiness too. I mean, it's the age of the little fat man as lover. It's irresistible to me.
Kommet doch, oh, kommt ihr bald, ihr Rinnen, folgt den süßen Weltertönen, wie sie singen, klingen, oh, tanzt doch mit, hebt eure Füßchen ein bisschen im Walzerschritt. Oh, kommet doch, oh, kommt ihr bald, ihr Rinnen, zögert nicht, das Fest zu krönen. Seht, da steht ein Tänzer her, also bitte, bitte sehr, wie die Blumen im Lenzer blühen, in leuchtenden Farben erglühen, so erblühet in rosigster Glut, lockender Töne Flut, wenn die Geige so zauberisch erklingt, Musik sich den Reigen erzwingt, denn frisch auf zögert nicht, denn die Jugend sie spricht, sie ist der Tanz holder Füßchen Pflicht. Gar oft hab ich's gehört, dass Witwen ach sind heiß begehrt, in ihrem Gelde liegt ihr Wert. So hab ich's immer gehört. Liefen, schweigen, flüster, geigen, hab mich lieb. All die Schritte sagen, bitte, hab mich lieb. Jeder Druck der Hände deutlich mehr.
beautifully floated cadence. I suppose in a way you could say that he does for Lehár what Janet Baker does for Bach and Bühling for Puccini, getting right inside the composer and giving it that elan.
That, yes. I mean, it's wonderful, isn't it, when you feel the performer and the composer just meet. They know each other. Bach, unfortunately, never knew Janet Baker. I'm sure he would have approved. But Lehár and Tauber knew each other, I believe. I'm sure they did. And I think Lehár at one point even wrote for Tauber. It might have been that some of those more preposterous things that I like Girls Were Made to Love and Kiss, Lehár wrote for Tauber, but I might be wrong.
Richard Tauber singing Lippenschweigen, the waltz song from the Merry Widow Act 3 by Lehár, and we heard the Odeon Künstler Orchester, conducted by, interestingly, Erich Wolfgang Korngold. Even your pop song, Howard Jacobson, is a rich piece.
10cc I liked very much for several reasons, the first being that I knew them. My brother Stephen played in a group, a Manchester group, which was very successful for a little while, called The Whirlwinds, which after a number of changes did become 10cc, Graham Gulman and Lol Cream and Kevin Godley being the ones from one group going into the other. By 10cc, my brother had left to become a painter. I knew these boys, and I hear the spirit of their 4 or 5 years younger than me, not even a half a generation. So I sort of hear something of myself and my friends in it, what Manchester was like then in the 60s. And it's a sort of cleverness, and it's an irony, but it's a very generous irony, actually. And it's a lot of the sentimentality which I've unashamedly betrayed to you, being shown and being hidden at the same time. It's another bittersweet song. I mean, it's pretending to be tougher than it is. I'm not in love, but I am in love. But it even knows it's pretending to be tough. It's a very clever song.
Just a silly phase I'm going through, and just because I call you up, don't get me wrong, don't think you got it made. I'm not in love, no, no.
It's because
big boys don't cry. Yeah. It's our mothers telling us big boys don't cry. You cannot overestimate the importance of being told by your mother big boys don't cry. And of course, the truth of it is big boys do cry. My novel is just about that, really, how big boys cry and cry and cry. It's one of the great male secrets that we don't cry, we don't, and we cry all the time. And I love that song for having the guts to say that.
That was 10cc and I'm Not in Love. We're going to share a mutual passion now, Howard Jacobson, for Australia. And actually, this particular piece by Percy Grainger, I've always loved. It's very moving, I think.
The Australian thing has got something to do with why I like Percy Grainger. I used to live in Melbourne for a while. There's a little bridge crossing the Yarra, which was either built or designed by his father. And every time I walked across it, I thought, I mean, Percy Grainger land somewhere. He's a completely fascinating figure, I think. Flamboyant and original and a wild genius with sexual preferences of a sort we couldn't even discuss now. I love all that in him. I think he really is one of the great originals. And his reputation as well, I suppose he's gone now, but there was a time when the ordinary man in the street thought that Percy Grainger did something with English country gardens. Mm. I mean, the music is fantastically powerful. Mm. And I think this song, which is a sea shanty and a love song. And I think it's a West Indian shanty. But it gets me away from... One of the things I like about it is it gets me out of the world of tenors and their querulous anxieties to a stronger, if you like, a stronger, deeper baritone sense of loss and just great strokes of... Just great pulses of feeling. I mean, it's love and death again, but the pulses of feeling are so strong.
Thank you.
It's a very curious, haunting piece, isn't it?
It's got the heave of the sea, isn't it? Yeah. I love that the trembling of the strings at that point, almost on a precipice. And then strange, the woodwind seems to just hints of light. But just the yearn, I mean, it is a song about yearning, isn't it? For your return, I'm burning. It's a, I don't know anything that's got, that renders yearning so profoundly, unbearably as that.
And I love the way they use the accents on the chorus, shallow. It's very dramatic. And I can see why that appealed to Britten, who conducted that performance, both in an operatic sense and, of course, his love of folk music. And it's not a million miles removed from his own early opera, Paul Bunyan, which is a sort of folkloristic piece. Well, we heard John Shirley Quirk with the Ambrosian Singers and the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Britten in Percy Grainger's Shallow Brown. Of course, you had an Australian novel, Redback.
Yes. And I wrote an Australian travel book too, in The Land of Oz, which we made a television film of. So I spent a lot of time there travelling around.
And do you look forward to doing your columns for The Independent, Howard? Is it nice to have a different kind of...
Yes, I adore it. Yeah. I adore it. I didn't think I would, but I adore it. I love the feeling that I am somewhere or other, no matter how marginally, in the culture each week, that I can sort of put my hand in. And because I very easily feel... You might be able to tell that from my choice of music. I very easily feel estranged. I quickly feel estranged. I quickly feel, you know, out into the shallow brown. And that sense of being able to talk, whoever's reading it, or that doesn't matter, but just that somewhere or other one is addressing something with a degree of, well, seriously, and one hopes with wit and pungency each week. I adore it. And I can't imagine life now without a column.
Well, thank you for addressing yourself to your musical tastes for us today. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Howard Jacobson was talking to Michael Barclay. That programme was first broadcast in June 2002, and since then, as you may well know, Howard Jacobson has written several more novels, of which his latest, The Finkler Question, won this year's Man Booker Prize. Well, next week on Private Passions, Michael Barclay's guest will be another prize-winning novelist, Adam Folds. That's next Sunday at 12 midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. This is BBC Radio 3. Very good afternoon from me, John Shea, with you this Sunday afternoon. In a couple of minutes, we have music by the 17th century Venetian composer Giovanni Legrenzi in today's edition of The Early Music Show. Now, though, with the time just after 1 o'clock, here's David Cornett with the latest BBC News.
China has called for an emergency meeting of envoys from the six countries which have been involved in the talks aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear weapons programme. The meeting would bring together the two Koreas, the United States, Japan, Russia and China itself. The US and South Korea have begun joint naval exercises in the Yellow Sea in response to the shelling of a South Korean island by the North last week. European finance ministers are expected to approve the terms of a major bailout for the Irish Republic today. Officials have spent the past 10 days thrashing out the details with the Irish government. Around half of the expected €85 billion of loans would be used to prop up Ireland's failed banks. American officials are continuing to warn governments around the world about thousands of confidential messages from the State Department, which are expected to be posted online tonight by the WikiLeaks website. The journalist Simon Hoggart of The Guardian, one of three newspapers to have seen the documents in advance, says the revelations will be embarrassing for Gordon Brown, but he said there'd be more embarrassment for David Cameron because a number of messages showed that he wasn't very highly regarded by the Obama administration. The polls have opened in Haiti's presidential election. President René Préval is barred by law from standing for re-election. The country, which was hit by an earthquake in January, is struggling to cope with a cholera epidemic. In Brazil, police say they've taken control of a shanty town in Rio de Janeiro, which had been run by drug traffickers. Heavily armed officers, supported by helicopters and armed vehicles, entered the narrow streets this morning. Hundreds of the traffickers have refused to surrender and are reported to have barricaded themselves in. And the weather forecast for this afternoon is for heavy snow, mainly in eastern and central Scotland, but spreading west to Northern Ireland later. Snow showers will continue along south and east coasts, spreading inland at times. Elsewhere, it'll be dry and cold, with sunny intervals. Temperatures will stay below freezing point in most areas. BBC News and weather at approaching 3 minutes past one.
David Cornett, thank you very much. Well, Fiona Talkington is here in just under an hour to present more of your Radio 3 requests. Join her for that at 2 o'clock. And then after that, as today is the first Sunday in Advent, at 4 o'clock we've a service for Advent with carols, the traditional live broadcast from the chapel of St John's College, Cambridge. That's this afternoon at 4. Before all that, here on BBC Radio 3, it's time now for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. Well, in keeping with our tradition of featuring some of the less well-known composers from the past, today we're exploring the life, and I hope you'll agree, the truly beautiful music of an Italian composer of the mid-17th century, Giovanni Legrenzi. And how nice that his story is, in the main, one of ambition fulfilled, of a man from humble beginnings who rose to take on the top job in Venice, that of musical director at St Mark's. But Legrenzi wasn't just a big fish in a relatively small sea. Even I was surprised to discover that he was quite a major force in the Italian Baroque, whose music was to influence Bach, Handel, Vivaldi, Scarlatti and Purcell, to name but a few. Legrenzi came from a musical family. His father was a parish violinist who dabbled in composing himself, so it was natural that his talented son, whose skills on the organ had so impressed the congregation of his small hometown in Clusone, would take his first professional post at the nearby city of Bergamo as organist at Santa Maria Maggiore. This was a magnificent church with a long and distinguished history of good music, so it was an excellent training ground for the 18-year-old Legrenzi, who remained firmly within its confines for some years, producing sacred music for the choir. But in the 1650s, Legrenzi was thinking about moving on. And with the publication of his first opus, a church mass, he was keen to make his name in the wider world. Let's hear the credo from the mass. Just four singers and an instrumental ensemble led by two concertanti violins with continuo, typical of the sort of small-scale forces that would have been heard in churches throughout northern Italy at this time.
Thank you.